Hi, I'm Michelle Nashan. I'm CEO of Wholesome Wave, a chef, and I love local food.
Michelle Nashan served as the honorary chairman of this year's Farm to Table International Symposium. Originally from Illinois, Michelle's relationship with food began on his grandfather's farm, where he spent many a summer sweating beneath the warm rays of the Midwestern sun.
My mom and dad used to send us down every summer because they worked hard and were lower middle class and struggled with income, so they would send us down for 6 to 8 weeks every summer to work what was left of my grandpa's farm because he couldn't afford the farmhands. She wanted us to learn chores and how to deal with animals and get fresh air and all that good jazz, and then she and my dad would take on extra work in the summer back home. So until my grandpa passed when I was 16 years old, that's how I spent my summertime. So I did kind of grow up on the farm.
Those summers stuck with him. Just like anyone else who's done farm work, Michelle developed an unwavering work ethic he'd put to the test at a relatively young age. At a time when most of us are planning to leave home, Michelle found himself in a similar situation, but he didn't have a choice.
So my mom and dad fell on hard times right when I was graduating high school. My older brother was graduated for a year, and they had to downsize and sell the house, and we had a younger brother and a younger sister, and my mom and dad had the talk with Steve and I that we really needed to go out on our own. And my mom looked to me, because I was the one who loved food. All my aunts and uncles could cook and pickle and can and hunt and butcher and all that stuff. And she said, "We're going to go get you a job in a restaurant, because at least you'll eat." She said, "You'll get two meals. You get one at the beginning of the shift, and you'll get one at the end of the shift. And at least I know that you'll be fed." So my first job was as a breakfast cook at a truck stop on the Illinois-Wisconsin border, called Center's Truck Stop on Russell Road. It's still there to this day. So that's how I got into the business. One thing led to another, and because I knew how to butcher and cook and all of those other things, I moved very, very rapidly.
And you found that you loved it. You must have loved it.
I absolutely loved it. I adored it to the depth of my soul. At the time, I really wanted to be a musician, because my mother was also very musical. She was a torch singer and very, very talented. But there was just no money in it. And certainly where there's no money, there's no food. So when I first got the job in the restaurant, I was a little reluctant. But then I started noticing a lot of similarities between the creative process of cooking and the creative process of musing, the collaborative process of that. If you want to be in a band, if you don't get along with everybody, the music's not going to be great. When it is great, the adoring public, whether it's concert goers or people sitting in a restaurant, really show genuine appreciation. So I just very, very quickly decided I was going to be a chef someday.
So 35 years ago, you were one of the very first people who ever sought out a farm-to-table connectivity. Tell us about how that was back then, and what were the obstacles you faced?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I did it assuming that it would be easier than it was, because of the way I had been raised. And even, you know, in Des Plaines, Illinois, my mom dug up the whole back and side yard and planted a garden. We canned, we pickled, we did our thing. I just thought that was normal. As a naive kid, I thought it was normal. I had no idea that it was a nearly extinct culture, right? I had no idea. So I started working in restaurants, and my big idea, my bright idea is I'll be a chef someday, and I'll be a better chef than anybody else, because the food coming in the back door of these restaurants is absolute crap. Pink tomatoes, perfectly round, tastes like not tomatoes. So I'll just go find farmers and I'll buy food from them, and then I'll kick all the other chefs' ass, right? So I got my first gig as a chef at the Fleur-de-Lis in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 1981, and I immediately did the short 20-minute drive out to Oconomowoc, where all the farms are, knocking on doors, getting doors slammed in my face, seeing all the corn, seeing all the soy, assuming there has to be a family vegetable plot somewhere, and found that it wasn't there. And I remember, you know, this one young family invited me in for coffee, and the wife had just inherited the farm from her parents. And she said, you know, until I was like 8 years old, we used to grow specialty crops, she called them. But we went to corn and soy. But, you know, there's this asparagus patch down by the access road. It's just lasted all these years. Take all you want. So it was my first farm-to-table acquisition ever, but it was also my only one that year. Nobody was growing anything, and it shocked me. It shocked me. So I kind of got angry first at myself that I was so naive as to think that all I had to do was find a farm and I'd find good food. And I became friends with these young farmers who said the money isn't in corn and soy, and telling me the woes that they and their farming communities were going through. I'm like, someone's got to do something about this. And I didn't know, you know, Alice was doing it in California, Nora Puyam was doing it in the mid-Atlantic in D.C., but we were all these lone little kind of islanders out there believing that food was that important and trying to get it done. And we would make 20, 30 phone calls and have very little of the food that we were serving in the restaurant come from any kind of a local farmer. It was really a wasteland at that time.
And then it becomes a little easier, and you are accessing local food. What was the customer's reaction to the fact that you had some local food from down the dirt road coming in the back door?
Well, the first was like they didn't want it. They didn't want it. They thought I was like some kind of a weird hippie. They're like, you're bizarre, man. You're picking your own asparagus. We had to stop talking about it because I wasn't going to stop trying to buy that food. I wasn't going to do it. I knew it was better. I knew I could trust these people. I could go and see how it was being grown, and I could have conversations. I knew enough about farming to have an intelligent conversation with somebody in the way that they were growing stuff. And I'm like, I'm not going to not do that. I owe it to my grandpa. You know, I owe it to my mom. I owe it to my dad. We're just not going to talk about it. So people would be like, oh my God, this is the most amazing asparagus in the world. What did you do to it? I'm like, kitchen secret, you know.
This
pork was like amazing. What'd you do? I have some really great staff in the back, and boy, do they know how to do pork. You just couldn't talk about it. Wow. People thought that all the produce that came in boxes, and they would see people in the grocery store in the produce aisle unloading these heads of romaine lettuce from a box, that it had gone through some kind of miraculous process that made it clean and pure, you know. So it was really a heavy lift. So not only were we, you know, making uncountable phone calls to have like 5% of our stuff come from local producers, we had to lie about it. By omission, we were not being genuine, and it was weird, you know. So I call those kind of like semi-dark ages, and I'm glad they're over.
So track how things changed. Track the change.
All right, so I would say about 15 years into it, I actually was getting to a point of what I felt was a modicum of success from the systems perspective, because I could make the same amount of phone calls and have like 40 to 50% of my stuff come from within a reasonable distance. So that was the other kind of semi-dark ages, because I could talk about it now and people would say, oh, how interesting, and then just not even seem like it registered beyond how interesting, right? Mm-hmm. And I would go out to tables and talk to people about it and try to get them all enthusiastic about it and stuff like that. And they're like, well, I really like having raspberries in February. I remember, you know, going through this phase of coming home to Lori, my beautiful wife, and saying, honey, I don't know if I can keep doing this. Nobody cares. Mm-hmm. You know, we learned that there was this kind of underground movement of us.
Yes, you all were a cult.
Yes, it's really so freaky, but people still think that way of us. So it's like there's this movement, but people weren't caring. I'm like, we're really doing this for future generations. And we would talk amongst ourselves and say, so we're going to just accept and we're going to bite this bullet. We're doing this for future generations, and we're going to keep doing stuff that is really hard to do that people just don't care about because we believe that it's important, right? So, you know, all of a sudden, 10 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, 10 years ago, boom, it started becoming important. Farmers market started popping up all over the damn place. And I think a lot of it had to do with people making the connection between food and human health. That was the big public awareness thing that happened. And it happened to me, you know, 20 years ago at that same time that I was convinced we were doing it for future generations, is when my son Chris, who is now 25 was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and the doctor went to great pains to tell me that what we did with his diet would have more to do with his long-term outcome than anything else. So I came to the understanding of the connection between food and human health. But what was interesting is that kind of like Jane Q. Public would go out and start shopping at farmers markets and then just saying, I don't care if anybody studies how I feel, but I just feel better. My food tastes better. I feel really great about the people I'm buying my food from. I've made new friends. There's direct human connection, this connection of trust, the culture that comes around it, the fact that from an economic perspective, they're spending money with farmers that live a very short distance away who are coming back into town and spending their money. And, you know, it's just
a sense of community that comes about with that sort of food exchange.
Yeah, in like real culture and sense of place. So 10 years ago, it like popped. And now we're at a point where we can make like a half a dozen to a dozen phone calls and have 100% of everything in our cooler. And after 35 years and with all these amazing young men and women coming out and really nailing farm to table now, it's just kind of like I wake up ready to go and I go to bed and fall right asleep. It's pretty cool.
That's Michelle Nishan, whose childhood on a Midwestern farm inspired him to pioneer the farm-to-table movement and change American food policy. When we come back, Michelle reveals how he became a social justice food revolutionary. Stay with us. If you're just joining us, we've been speaking with Michelle Nishan, a chef whose commitment to local food has changed the way Americans eat. As commonplace as the farm-to-table movement is today, it might surprise you that Michelle spent years lying to his patrons about where their food was coming from. It ate him up inside, but about 10 years ago, people's attitudes towards food changed, which coincidentally is roughly the same time he got involved with Paul Newman, Cool Hand Luke himself. As a financial backer, Paul pushed Michelle into the next phase of his career, CEO of Wholesome Wave, a nonprofit that uses food to benefit local economies and tackle poverty.
He calls me one day and says, Michelle, it's Newman. I need you to come to the theater. So I go there and he's standing at the top of the stairs and you walk up to this little mezzanine where they let you into the theaters, and he had two chairs facing each other and had somebody unscrew every light bulb in the ceiling except the one over the two chairs. So he's like, have a seat. And we sit down just like you and I are across from each other. He's like, would you just please do this goddamn restaurant with me? And by that time, I had completely fallen in love with the guy. And I said, okay. For the first time in my life, I had a restaurant where I didn't have to argue with anybody. We believed in the same things. And he's just one of the most humanly genuine people I had ever met. And it's one of the most valuable things I ever did in my life, to be able to really go for something that I believed in with the support of somebody who believed in the same things, but then had proven himself beyond the wealth he was amassing because of his popularity and the way he just turned it back into philanthropic cause and trying to make change. So it was just an amazing thing.
Well, that was only the beginning of what I suspect probably turned into the most rewarding thing for both you and Paul Newman, Wholesome Wave. Tell us about Wholesome Wave and the work you two did together on that.
So it's interesting because when we did the restaurant, I did have, you know, a couple of conditions. One condition was that my wife and my kids could eat there and that Lori could work there, because that's how we met. We met in the business. And the other was that I was trying to do something about people in underserved communities, communities of poverty. I really believe that everybody should have a right to the same tomato or the same peach. Everybody should be able to deliver really great ingredients to their table, regardless of income. We used to be that way in this country. It used to be easy to do that. And he said, well, sounds like a nonprofit to me. Why don't you just found the damn thing? So my feeling was all of this stuff that was getting bandied about and published back then, because Kellogg Foundation had funded all of these farmers markets and underserved communities, and they were failing without the grant money, and a lot of people assumed that it was because of lack of demand or lack of education. I really felt that it was lack of affordability. So we decided the easiest way to prove whether there was a market or not was just raise private money and double the value of food stamps at farmers markets. So we started in late 2007. By early 2008, we were in 3 states and 8 markets, and it was taking off like wildfire. And within 5 years, we were in like 26 states, close to 300 markets, urban, rural, north, south, east, west, and collecting the stories and proving that consumers in poverty really are consumers, that they do want to feed their families better, that they just don't have the affordability. When we gave them the affordability, they would immediately shift the way they were spending their SNAP and then provide additional support to small and mid-sized farmers, which are classic American small businesses. And we measured that impact, and we were able to share it in Washington. And the farm bill that just passed has $100 million supporting that program now. So we're very proud of that. Wouldn't have happened if Newman didn't say, just like with the restaurant, just like, sounds like a nonprofit to me. Just get off your tuchus and do something about it.
Well, I have to tell you that personally, that is one of the most brilliant pieces of work in food that I have seen in my lifetime. And I have had a lot of up close and personal experience watching the success of that program. Because if I'm correct, Richard McCarthy at the Crescent City Farmers Market was one of your early adapters.
Yeah, absolutely. They were, and they just hit it out of the park. And the interesting thing is we even learned from them on the evaluation, because they were doing excellent evaluation. Richard's just one of the most brilliant guys in the world. So they were doing, I believe, 4 markets, and we became really fast friends. I remember when Katrina happened, one of our donors, the donor advisor that works with us, said, listen, our anonymous donor wants to do something in the Gulf area. So, I mean, we could have come down here and done something, but what we did was we called Richard and said, hey, Richard, our donor wants us to do something. We'd rather you get the money, you know? So how can we work together? We'll take out of the grant whatever it costs us to maybe fly down and have a couple of meetings, but you guys get the money and do something. So they created this thing for shrimpers to get into farmers markets in communities, get them away from the water,
get them
away from the oil, get them
to
restaurateurs, get them to see a show, you know,
let them. The White Boot Brigade.
Yeah.
Who do you think was head of the White Boot Brigade? Me.
Oh, awesome. Okay. Oh, I didn't know. That's awesome. I didn't know that.
The White Boot Brigade didn't go anywhere that I didn't go. And in fact, yeah. Alice was so wonderful and generous because she was part of our big hookup on the West Coast
when we took
the shrimpers to the West Coast. That was
so
fantastic.
That, you know, it's just brilliant, brilliant people out there. And that's how we work. We have a network of over 60 nonprofits that do the work. And now it leads to our other programs, which are, you know, you need those emissaries on the ground. We don't want to be the organization that goes to a community and hangs our shingle out the door. So our nonprofit partners, they call the program whatever they want. The only thing we charge them is that they manage the alternative currency fraud-free, and they have to do the data collection so we can build the case for policy change. You know, whatever the hell you think is best for your community, you've established the trust, you've established the connection with the members in need. They're going to trust you. The best thing that we can do is just put a good idea in your hands and let you run with it. And we're really proud of that.
Now, your latest project is called Doctors as PHAMERS, Doctors as Farmers. How can doctors farmers?
So that's our fruit and vegetable prescription program. Our theory of change is that there are big pots of federal money that are not being spent well. The intention is good. They're not being spent well. If we can shift the way they get spent, we might have a better outcome. So our theory with food stamps is if we could get people to spend 40% of their food stamp dollar on locally grown fruits and vegetables, they will be heroes of a changed food system. SNAP was $80 billion last year. $80 billion. If $20 billion of that could go to local food, there aren't enough local food farmers to take care of that. So it could really create system change. So we look at the Affordable Care Act. We look at Medicaid. We look at a variety of policy drivers around pots of money outside of the farm bill that could be shifted towards local food. So our whole premise was food is medicine. The prescription pipeline exists. Let's change what's in the pipeline from drugs at the back end to food in the front end. So again, raising private money We gathered doctors, nutritionists, community health workers, our implementing partners on the ground at the farmers markets, and got them to work as a community of practice, our version of comprehensive care. Before our program, the doctor would see a family and say, you're obese or overweight, trending obese, your daughter's pre-diabetic, your husband has high blood pressure and is obese. If you guys don't do something to change your diet, the next time I see you, someone's either going to have a heart attack or be diabetic or whatever it might be. Family goes home. They do their food budget. They take a couple of buses, get to a grocery store. They have $2 to spend for dinner for a family of four. A head of broccoli is $2, or an 8-pack of instant noodles is $2, or $1.49. You get four bowls of noodles out of all of that. The husband and wife, that's all they have, and then they buy two little bags of cheese thingies so the kids don't cry hungry before they go to bed. They decide they can't change their diet. So what happens? Someone passes out at work. A year from now, they go back. They have type 2 diabetes, but now that same doctor can give them free diabetes medicine, because we won't let somebody perish because they have a chronic disease, right? So what we've done is made it possible. So when the doctor sees that family the first time, says, you need to improve your diet, and here's a prescription to do that. They give the family a prescription, and it's the whole family. So the entire family gets to increase their consumption of fruits and vegetables, a serving per day per person. They have to go to the dietitian or the nutritionist to get the prescription. They get all the health and the coach counseling, you know, increase your physical activity, here's how. Community health worker takes them for the farmer's market tour, introduces them to the farmers and our implementing partner on the ground. They have their prescription. It has a monetary value. They get their fruits and vegetables. And then to get a refill monthly, they have to go back and be measured for health outcomes. And 3 years in a row now, 41% of our index patients have dropped their BMI in a 14-week intervention, where 100% were expected to stay the same or increase their BMI. So we're proving that food is medicine. It's no longer something that we're doing for future generations. I've seen more change in the last 8 years than I had ever hoped to see in a lifetime when I was thinking really big thoughts. You know, so it's awesome.
It is awesome. My last question for you is, you've already proved yourself to be a visionary, a big thinker who thinks out the box and makes it happen. When you look in your crystal ball, what's the goal? What's going to happen next? What is your most outlandish dream for the future?
Okay. So, well, first of all, if I had a crystal ball, I'd win the lottery. That would be awesome. To me, it's less visionary than I think it's common sense. You know, my mom and dad were farmers, and I think all of the activity that we're seeing around these programs just really allows common sense to happen again. There's no such thing in my mind as any parent, unless they're really have a real psychological problem. There's no such thing as a parent who doesn't want the best for their family. We need to get the resources back in the hands of the family unit, so that they have the resources to provide the best for their families. And I believe through doing that, because it all has to happen through food, food can save everything. Food can fix human health, environmental health, societal health, economic health. It's the building block of all culture. You know, fix food, you fix everything. And I believe it's these citizens of poverty that are going to be the heroes of our changed food system. That's what I see for the future.
Thank you, Michelle. You are the best. I'm so grateful you took this time to sit down with us. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
Michelle Nishan, CEO of Wholesome Wave. If you want to get involved with your community's food scene, Michelle recommends websites like localfood.org or his own, wholesomewave.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.